I'm Tom Rowe. You're listening to a special edition of Turn on the News, 313.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. We're looking at the TransX Transmission Art Symposium, May 25th through 27th in Toronto, Canada, hosted by New Adventures in Sound Art. And today we're going to listen to David Cecchetto's keynote address, one of the keynote addresses at the TransX Transmission Art Symposium. This was on Sunday, May 27th, and it's titled Sound as Transmission, Towards and Away from the Non-Cochlear Ear. New Adventures in Sound Art, Darren Copeland introduces David Cecchetto.
We are pleased to present David Cecchetto, here, based here in Toronto now, and his keynote address, Sound as Transmission, Towards and Away from Non-Cochlear Sound Art. And in his note, he says, the expanded understanding of sound that resists the implicit claims to authenticity of both Schaeffer's sound itself and Cage's attentional injunction nonetheless includes both, and it is precisely through the ambivalence that we can fully embrace sound's potential to reconfigure or refigure contemporary forms of communication, and particularly networks. And discussed will be two projects, SRMP and Exurbia.
I'm going to start with two things that I'm not going to explain, in addition to the sound that I'm not really going to talk about, but two things that I'm not going to explain. But it served for me as kind of Zen cones for this topic that I want to talk about today, which is really the question of the medial specificity of sound. So, what is actually specific to sound as a medium? So the Zen cone, right, is contemplating the sound of one hand clapping. So these are two things that, for me, have served as that sort of function. And one is this equation that you can see on the screen for the people on the radio. It's x over y equals x over z. So you could probably see how this would solve, right? I'm not a mathematician, so tell me if I'm wrong, but I presume it could solve one of two ways, or two of two ways, and one is to have x equals 0, right? Which is, of course, a kind of total abstraction. Or the other is to have y equal z, which was just to say that x over y equals x over y. And to me, again, I'm not going to explain why this is beguiling to me, but it's something that that I spend a lot of time thinking about, because numbers are always abstract, sound is always abstract, and I think there's some correlations between the history of numbers and the history of sound, and the ancient Greeks had no number zero, right? So it's like a total abstraction, something to contemplate. The other maybe less serious cone is something that's been with me for about 12 years, and if you're one of the like 12 people in the world who have heard my music from 12 years ago, you'll know that I actually used to feature it in a number of pieces when I was still a composer, I'm a cultural theorist primarily now. And that's a joke, and it goes like this. Jokes don't have to be funny, by the way. I think this one's funny, but it might not be. So these two farmers are watching the installation of the first telephone lines in their region. And the one farmer turns to the other and he says, I just don't understand these contemporary technologies. They're so complicated. And the second farmer says, well, they're not. You just have to know how to think about them. So take the telephone, for example, right? It's just like a really long wiener dog. And you grab its tail at your house and it barks somewhere in the middle of the city, right? And the guy thinks about it. He says, okay, yeah, I get that. But then how do you explain radio? He says, well, radio is exactly the same, but without the dog. So as I said, I don't have time to go into why these are beguiling to me, but I think they both point to the ways, exactly what we're thinking about when we think about this. What I recognize is a somewhat academic, but I hope also artistic question of medial specificity. So what I'm going to try to do today is just offer some thoughts on the medial specificity of sound, right, which is to say, on a set of metaphors, materials, and discourses that we imply when we're talking about sound, right? When we're talking, we're always talking in metaphors, materials, and discourses. So I'm going to address the question of transmission obliquely rather than directly. What I hope is that maybe I can help to catalyze some emerging connections that I think are there between transmission art and the discourses of sound art, new media, and contemporary critical theory, which is my sort of lingua franca. So maybe I can contribute to this kind of collective storm that's happening at this symposium that's really been making my head spin in the best way. I think there is a connection between sound art, new media art, and contemporary critical theory, and transmission art, and I think that's actually, you know, we even see that in this institution, NASA, right, which has a history, a strong history of sound art, and so obviously that's leveraged in transmission art. So, as somebody who does cultural theory, for lack of a better word, I'm in the business of crafting arguments, right, and that's rather than talking about, I am going to talk about a couple pieces, maybe just one, because I have a tendency to digress, so one or two pieces, but really I'm in the business of crafting arguments, and that's the way I want to talk about my work. When I say I'm in the business of crafting arguments, what I mean is I'm in the business, if it's a business, it has to make money. I'm in the habit of crafting arguments, the habit of building fictions about what it is that I'm doing, right, that can help us, or help me at least, to live in the world a little differently. So some of what I'm going to say is going to enter some conversations that you'd encounter, you know, at conferences or through certain literature in the area, but I'm really entering it not in the spirit of proving somebody right or wrong, so much as just trying to pressure some of these things to say, well, how can this help me and by extension possibly you think differently about our art practices? So the argument that I want to enter into, or the conversation I want to enter into, is specifically one that is somewhat well known, published in a book by Seth Kim Cohen, sound artist, sound theorist. And the book is called Towards a Non-Cochlear Sound Art. And basically in that book, Kim Cohen's arguing for a discursive turn in sound art, right? A movement away from thinking about sound as this kind of way of just encountering the world, of uncovering the truth of the world, right? And instead thinking about sound art in connection to visual art practices. I'll talk about that a bit more. But what I want to do with that argument is just push it a little bit towards something that I'm calling, as of this week, calling the sonic effect. So for me, what I mean by this term sonic effect, instead of sound, right? So sound implies there's something concrete there. What I mean by sonic effect is what Brian LaBelle, who I know many of you know, or some of you, what he calls micro-epistemologies, right? Which is just this way of recognizing that things like echoes, vibrations, rhythms, for instance, if we think through those metaphors, right, they open up specific ways of knowing the world. That's sort of what I'm trying to do, is take these two very divergent arguments and see if there's a way to kind of mash them up a little bit in the spirit of audio art. So you can see already, I think, that there's a connection here, obvious connection to the concerns of transmission art, which pushes, I think, I would argue, many of these oral metaphors, things like waves, right, which have a history in sound art, pushes those metaphors in new directions. We understand waves very differently when we start to think about transmission than we do in the history of sound and music. So I'm going to make that argument, and then I'm going to talk about a creative work that I think specifically enacts that, if you will, Exurbia. And what this piece Exurbia does is it experiments with oral, what I'm calling oral avatars, it's a bit of a stretch to call them that, in a non-visual online community. Right? So it's a kind of non-visual, non-textual as well, telepresence community, to use a term, telepresence, that doesn't get used much anymore. And then if there's time, as a kind of bonus track to the talk, I'll also talk about SRMP, but I can already see that that's unlikely to happen. Certainly I'm happy to answer any questions. When we're done, maybe you could share any thoughts you have, or we can discuss further. I can answer questions. So, part one, medial specificity and this sonic effect. The problem of medial specificity, for those of you connected to the visual arts, is actually quite familiar. And what's interesting is, to a large extent, as a question, I mean, it still is active as a practice, but as a question, there's a certain sense in which it's long resolved, right? And specifically, the way that it's resolved is through a notion of expansion, the term expansion. This we find in Gene Youngblood, 1970s, talking about expanded cinema. Rosalind Krauss, really famously in 79, talks about expanded sculpture. And basically, what expansion is, it connects to at the time, contemporary philosophical movements, somebody like Jacques Derrida, you might have heard his grammatology, but basically it's just a way of recognizing the porousness of an artwork's boundaries, right? So the implicit verb in any frame, right? Mika Bal, the visual theorist, talks about every frame is actually a framing, right? It's not just a frame to a work, it's an act of framing. It happens in time, in a certain sense. And then also, you know, expansion is just a way then generally of recognizing the way that artworks, culture, discourse are all tangled up in one another. So if you know Clement Greenberg, right, expansion is kind of explicitly in opposition to some of his writing, sometimes correctly, sometimes falsely. But it's basically just saying, Greenberg, to the contrary, the work of art, when we talk about it doing something, we can't reduce that to just the boundaries of the work itself. Right, and those boundaries aren't uncontested or fixed. So if you think about a picture in a gallery, right, we can say, oh yeah, that's the work, right? You put it on a wall, but by putting it on a wall, the wall becomes part of the work, the gallery becomes part of the work, the mechanism of entering and leaving, the institutional support, all those are in a sense part of the work of art, which sounds glib or stupid in some ways, but really, if you've ever worked in an artist-run center, you understand these things come about in really material and specific ways. Right? Even just think about the difference between, I was involved with a really great artist front center, and none of the visual artists would even consider the idea of having to pay to enter the space. Right? And yet, you had to pay to enter the space to go to a concert. Right? So it's these silly things, so all of a sudden our community would be split between the visual artists who would come to all the free openings, but not pay $10 to sit still and listen to, you know, a show for an hour. Right? So So the way that it's framed, the mechanism of ticketing, of paying, of coming, all those things are part of what it is, part of what the artwork is. Part of being a visual artist in that context, that specific context, is not paying to see work, but the work is kind of a discussing point. So this conversation is actually pretty much old hat in the various discourses that we'll just call the visual arts, even though visual artists don't often like that term. But it's remained only peripheral. It's not excluded, but only peripheral to the discourses of music, and I would argue also to sound art, though the latter is in a little bit less obvious way. So with respect to music, just as a quick digression, and specifically I'm talking about what, it's, you know, music has these awesome terms, they're just hilarious, like Western art music is an actual term, and to describe this notated music that is performed by orchestras, ensembles, that sort of thing. So in that respect, it's maybe not surprising that there's a kind of foundational conservatism to that discourse, right, that comes from it having a history in sacred practices, specific sacred practices, a history in colonial practices as well. So it's not necessarily that shocking that it's difficult for that to move, for those institutions to be kind of flexible in the way that the visual arts institutions are. But also with music, and this is what's going to sort of get us to sound art, and I think more importantly, there's what is discussed as a medial purity really at the heart of music. It's endowed with as music. And the most famous sort of statement that summarizes this is the 19th century critic and essayist Walter Pater. And he makes this famous or infamous claim that gets repeated, you know, ad infinitum, that all art constantly aspires to the condition of music, he says. Right? And the reason he says that, or what that claim does is it perfectly encapsulates the fiction of music, right? And we live by fictions all the time in every way, so it's not to say whether it's good or bad, but the fiction of music, right, as a kind of pure abstraction, right, something that doesn't relate to anything in the world, it relates to nothing but itself. So Pater's claim, right, that all art constantly aspires to the condition of music, it puts music as the kind of purest of the arts, precisely because its artness, what makes it art, only refers to itself, right? You don't listen to a piece of Bach and say, oh yeah, that's a piece by Bach, and say, oh yeah, that's about the problem of the terrible, terrible oppression of First Nations people in Canada. Right? It's just, you can't, it's very, very difficult to do that at the level of the music. So another way of saying this, since it's always nice to have multiple ways, is to say that music is positioned as being asemiotic, right? Which is to say that it is positioned as not reflecting anything except for music, right? And that's the kind of, that is the heart of music. So And you can see this, Seth Kim Cohen, in the book that I'm going to discuss, points this out really brilliantly. He says, you know, only music has a term like extra musical, right? A term that actually is there so that describes things like staging, political references, performance practices, marketing, all that as though they're not part of the piece of music, right? The term simply doesn't exist in the visual arts, the gallery arts. The extra artistic part or the extra visual part, right? So music has at its core this fiction that the music itself is pure abstraction. So the point I'm getting to is that this means that you can't necessarily address the problem of music and discourse, this problem of how music connects to the world, just by expanding the semantic field of music, right? Because the semantic field, these discursive elements in the world, aren't part of music. It's like a sort of two ships passing in the night situation. And the decisive example here, and the most famous one, and the one that's going to get us closer to sound art, is the work of John Cage, right? Which would seem to, on its surface, deploy exactly this kind of expanded field, right? I'm sure everybody knows Cage's work, but he extensively uses chance operations, aleatorism, right? And he technologizes silence. He says... he treats silence as though it's something tangible and positive. And these are both in service, as well as other techniques, of an understanding that would move music off of the page, right, and beyond the purview of a kind of intentional composerly rhetoric, right? So Cage's intervention expands this musical palette to include sounds in themselves and silence, independent of their notation and organization, which is great. And indeed, the ultimate sound... in itself, the ultimate sound in itself for Cage is silence, right? And I'm sure everybody knows this kind of apocryphal story of his experience in an anechoic chamber, but in case you don't, right, he's sitting in this chamber that seals him off from the world, and he hears these two sounds, which he attributes to being the sound of his blood circulating and his nervous system. In fact, the technicians at the time have said, you know, it's quite possibly just has early onset tinnitus, and that's one of the pitches that he's hearing. But it doesn't even matter, right? So he hears these two sounds in a situation that is supposed to seal him off from all sound. And so for Cage, this is like this amazing revelation. And it really is, right? And the revelation is that there's no such thing as silence, right? Which in turn means that sound isn't just this addition to reality. Sound is an ever-present stratum. Reality. Right? So if we want to talk about the world, you want to talk about this coffee cup, you have to talk about it relative to sound as well as relative to its paper, right? It's kind of a profound, you know, it's one of those things that you're like, yeah, of course, and then, you know, generations of artists continue to make work based on that, you know, being what that catalyzes. So, Cage's gestures of expansion really broaden the rhetorical palette available to musicians. And I think also constitute an important politics within music. But they don't impact the purview of the rhetoric of music. They don't impact what... they change how music can speak. But we can't just assume that changes what music can say. So there's a kind of expansion towards inclusivity of practices, I would argue, is actually accomplished via a kind of colonizing process that doesn't address, I mean, it does lots of wonderful things, right? But it doesn't address this fiction of music as being purely abstract. It doesn't address what I would call the discursive insularity that prevents music from talking about its connections to the world, right? Its concrete existence in the world. And this is the case because, you know, there's a really problematic assumption that lies at the heart of Cage's project. And again, there's a problem at the heart of everybody's project, right? All you can do is love John Cage, right? So please don't misunderstand that. But there's a problematic assumption that's at the heart of that project, namely that sound, again, somehow just signifies itself, right? That when we hear sound, it's a sound. And language, discourse, experience, the body, the world has nothing to do with it, right? So my friend Eldridge Priest argues that Cage's effort to open musical experience to a wider materiality through these kind of gestures, right, can only be made effective through a kind of rhetorical mover that basically ciphers off anything in the sound that isn't the sound, right? So any sound is musical so long as it's intentionally heard as music and unheard as being in the world. The maybe more famous That's from Eldridge's forthcoming book on Continuum. Really, really fantastic book. It's coming out in a year or so. The more famous source for that similar argument, though, is Douglas Kahn in the book Noise, Water, Meat, right? And he says, under the guise of an opening up of sounds to the world, Cage builds a kind of musical bulwark against auditive culture, right? One founded on a musical identification with nature itself. So Kahn argues convincingly that basically this is accomplished through these very techniques of expansion that would seem to put Cage in this visual arts discourse, right? So by extending the process of music making or music incorporation to include all audibility, potentially audible and mythically audible sounds, there's no longer, there are no more sounds to incorporate into music, right? So music then becomes a kind of pure listening, a pure concentration. And of course, the reference here is to Cage's 433, the silent piece, right? So where's this sort of taking us? The medial specificity of sound in music means that any additional elements that are brought into music become colonized by music. They become music, right? They're not political. They're not in the world. They are music. And what is music? Music is this pure, abstract thing. So music can never be medially specific in a certain sense because its specificity exists only prior to any particular instantiation of it, right? Whatever happens, it's going to be music, right? And indeed, you know, we see this in performances all the time. Artists leverage this all the time, right? In this setup, if I were here as a musician, not as a talking head, whatever I hear, you'd be prepared to hear as music, I think. Hopefully, you'd be so generous. If anybody is in contemporary media studies, we would say that music presents itself as an origin, as a kind of creation myth of sound, rather than as a history of sound. And if you want to understand why that's important, just think about the difference between creation myths and history that are played out, for example, in the U.S. around the Christian right and evolution. That's the difference between a creation myth and a history. One is in the world, caught up in thinking about our values as being historically constituted, always changing, and we are changing. One says, this is right, this is wrong. So, to speak about musical specificity in music is as fraught as speaking about truth in painting, sculpture, and all of these things that are kind of discussed in the visual arts and, in a certain sense, dismissed with the decline of modernism, right? When painting sort of leaves this gesture towards being pure painting and starts to engage its being in the world. But there's a really important distinction between how that's happened in the discourse of music from the discourse of visual arts. So in the case of visual arts, there are all these conceptual terms, right? I don't mean the capital C conceptual term. I mean all these different ways of thinking about how we think is part of these works, right? And they happen one after another. You think Duchamp, Picasso, pick a name post, well, somebody pick a name and pick a date, and after that date, it's filled with these conceptual terms, right? 20th century visual art is, in a certain sense, defined in that way. And these explicitly engage this kind of paradox that we can focus on a work, and by focusing on the work, we can focus on the things that aren't in the work, if that makes sense, right? It's like a kind of resonant object for the world. In a certain sense, that's what art does. There are all these things that connect to the work. By focusing on the work, you pretend that the work is cut off from the world so that you can have fresh insight into the world or something like that. I don't know. But music deals with its excesses, deals with its way of connecting to the world in a really dramatically different way, and that way is called sound art. Right? Kim Cohen says in his book, he says, sound art is positioned, and I think he's right, as a discrete practice, separate from music. I think this group would testify to that, right? It's a discrete practice, and it's the remainder created by music closing off its borders to the extra musical, right? So this isn't the result, and this is really important, it's not the result of specific decisions by specific people, right, within sound art and music. It's not like somebody says, I'm going to be a sound artist or I'm going to be a musician. It's a result of them being very different histories, right? And as far as music goes, there is no other option available except to treat sound art as a separate set of practices altogether. Again, just think of the biographies of the individual practitioners, right? And there's actually relatively little overlap. So sound art becomes, in a certain, in this story that we're telling becomes a way of solving music's problem of closing off its connections to the world. Music becomes, in sound art, a historical practice, which is a good thing, right? It becomes a historical practice concerned, if we want to talk about music, right, its history is concerned with itself as music. You want to talk about sound art, all of a sudden it's situated in the world. It's a historical practice that is situated relative to the various political histories of the world. Wonderful, right? So, but the problem isn't quite that easily solved. It would be nice if it were, right? And here again, we'll return just briefly to Douglas Kahn talking about Cage. And he noticed that in this myth of listening, and I apologize if you've read the book, but it's really, really an incredible insight, right? In this myth of listening, where Cage hears two sounds, whatever they are, right? And understanding that this is the moment, this is the origin, this is the inception of sound art in a certain way, right? In this myth of listening, when he hears two sounds, he's hearing a third, right? And that, what is, I mean, you could probably predict what that third sound is, and namely, it is the sound of his little voice in his head saying, hey, whoa, I'm hearing two sounds even though I'm in an anechoic chamber, right? And this, calling this a sound, right, is, of course, totally antithetical to Cagean listening, right? Because it means that there's something in competition with the sounds themselves in the world.
That was David Cecchetto at the New Adventures in Sound Arts TransX Transmission Arts Symposium, May 27, 2012, in Toronto, Canada, with Sound as Transmission, Towards and Away from Non-Cochlear Sound Art. You can hear the entire file at freee103point.org or newsroom.free103.9.org. This is Free103.9's Turn on the News, a daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, and sound art. I'm Tom Rowe.
The preceding show was produced by Free103.9 at the WGXC Studios in New York.